Welcome to the End of Innocence. I'm your host, John Young. Last week, we listened to part one of a rare 1966 interview with Penn Jones Jr. on KPFA Radio. We heard an introduction to the interview by well-respected author and researcher James DiEugenio. In the introduction, DiEugenio expresses what great respect and admiration he has for Penn Jones for showing the courage to hunt down and interview witnesses in Dallas in those early days of the investigation into the president's murder. Penn literally lost everything because of his work on the assassination, but he refused to let up, even till the day he died. This week, we will hear part two of that interview. You will hear Penn discuss Jack Ruby's relationship with the Dallas police, his effort to track down witnesses of the assassination in Dallas that were reluctant to speak with him because they were afraid and they were told not to speak to anyone about what they had saw the day of the assassination. You will also hear him speak about some of the mysterious deaths of people that may have had some information about the assassination or Lee Harvey Oswald. And finally, you will hear Penn comment about a very important person that may have had information to blow the case wide open. But unfortunately, she was also one of those mysterious deaths. I'm talking, of course, about Dorothy Kilgallen. Enjoy part two of this historic interview with Penn Jones Jr.
Going back to Ruby himself and the shooting of Oswald, my feeling after reading the book is that you feel there's definitely a link between Ruby and Oswald, and I want to ask the question, more than one of the leading critics on the case feels that there was no link. In other words, that no link is needed to prove a conspiracy in the president's death. Why do you feel that there is a link? Is it necessary that there to have been a link between Ruby and Oswald?
Well, I don't think it is necessary that there be a link, but I do think there was a link.
Why?
Between Ruby and Oswald. Well, in the book, I quote the letter, which was sent to the FBI director by an attorney in Dallas by the name of Carol Jarnigan. And Jarnigan, in this letter to the FBI director, outlines a purported meeting that was held between Ruby and Oswald in Ruby's Carousel Club. A good many people, the Warren Commission did not call Carol Jarnigan as a witness. And apparently, I don't know why they didn't call him, but the only reason I can find in the testimony is that Henry Wade claims that he had this attorney take a lie detector test. And from the lie detector test, Wade said that Jarnigan's story was a pure fantasy. He said Jarnigan thinks it happened, but it didn't really happen.
Well, a number of people who've read the Jarnigan testimony wonder if he's truly stable or whether it can be.
Well, after all of the other kooks that the commission called and listened to and believed, I think that whether this man is a kook or not, he should have been allowed to come and tell his story to the commission so that we all could maybe evaluate it and not rely upon the lie detector techniques of the Dallas Police Department.
How many witnesses were not called to testify before the commission? I mean witnesses to the assassination.
I think it would have run into the dozens.
These people are accessible to you today, are they, many of them?
Well,
my feeling, you see, after going and visiting you in Dallas and traveling around somewhat, was the feeling, I had a feeling that there was fertile ground for an additional investigation of the assassination, people that might be able to yield up genuine information and that there were possible leads. I think many people said, well, at this date, so many clues have been watered over that it would be very difficult to gain access to people who had something to say or were willing to talk. I didn't feel that.
No, that's not true, Bill. I could keep, if I could afford it, I could keep two investigators busy in the Dallas area checking legitimate leads that are still developing in the city. Now, these people are reluctant. Many of them are frightened. Many of them refuse completely to have anything to do with you, and that includes the widow of one of the most recent people to die. Who was a witness at the assassination site.
Who was that?
That was Lee Bowers, was an employee in the railroad tower at the time of the assassination.
Yes.
And he saw some unusual activities going on behind the wooden fence and wasn't permitted or was interrupted by the commission attorney so that he later said they didn't want to hear what I wanted to say. Well, Bowers was died on August the 9th, I believe, in an automobile accident 2 miles west of my town in Midlothian, Texas. And I called the widow immediately and told her as soon as she felt like it, I wanted to talk to her about this. And she said, well, no, my husband had been told not to talk about this. And so I'll have nothing to say to you. And I have called her again since then. But it appears there that that's one that will not talk to him. But there are a dozen of others that after a little coaching, after a little urging, might talk to us.
Now, you list a number of what you call peripheral deaths as related to the assassination. You have one chapter in which you, I believe, list Dorothy Kilgallen as one of those peripheral deaths. I wonder if you could explain that. I realize that Dorothy Kilgallen was a correspondent covering the Ruby trial for the New York Journal American, I believe it was. And she made the contention that information was furnished to Ruby's attorneys, privileged information from the FBI or what have you, as long as they would not raise the question or ask questions concerning Oswald and the assassination per se. Is that a fair representation of what Ms. Kilgallen said?
Yes. I covered the Ruby trial, and Ms. Kilgallen was there, I believe, only two or three days. But while she was there, Judge Joe B. Brown, after he invited Ms. Kilgallen to his offices, to his chambers, and they spent an hour and a half during a recess in his chamber, just the two of them. And then the judge came out and sent Ruby into the judge's chambers with Miss Kilgallen, where they talked alone they were in the room alone for 30 minutes. Now, she is the only news person who got this special privilege, and you can check that by some of the other national commentators who were present, and they were mad as they were quite angry because they were not given this privilege. So I contend that she is the only human being that has talked to Ruby alone in a room that was not bugged since he killed Oswald. And then I think that it's with her death, it seems that she should be included, along with Bill Hunter of Long Beach and Jim Cody of Dallas and Hank Kilgallen, who was killed over in Florida, and Whaley.
I wonder if you could tell us after, we'll get back to Dorothy Kilgallen, but about Hunter, the person that was killed in Long Beach. Who is that?
Well, Bill Hunter is a Dallas native and was in Dallas at the time visiting his parents when the president's visit, so he was covering for his newspaper when the president was killed and stayed on to cover over the next several days and came back to Long Beach and wrote a prize-winning account of the assassination. And on Sunday afternoon, after Ruby had killed Oswald, Bill Hunter and a longtime friend, Jim Cody, made an arrangement to meet with Senator in the apartment which Senator and Ruby shared.
Yes.
There's one person present that I will not reveal his name because he claims he wants to stay alive, but Bill Hunter and Jim Cody and Tom Howard and George Senator went on a tour of the apartment talking, and what they talked about, I don't know. I wasn't present, but I will say that Bill Hunter was killed in the police station here in Long Beach, shot to death by a policeman from what the report said, more than 3 feet. Jim Cody was killed in his apartment in Dallas almost a year after the assassination. And Tom Howard died under rather peculiar, rather strange circumstances in Dallas of what the hospital said was apparently a heart attack. There was no autopsy. So three of those men died. And I know that Hunter was working on the story, and I know that Jim Cody was associated with two other men in working in preparing a book on the assassination.
I see.
And Cody's assignment was the detailed study on the leaders in Dallas.
What gives you the conviction? You obviously have it. I'm sure you can't adduce proof, but what gives you the conviction that these murders, or these deaths, I should say, peripheral deaths, are related, and that they are primarily related to people who might give us information about the case? I suppose you're saying that it's self-evident in the testimony that you presented in the book.
I think it's evident enough that there should be some serious investigation. Now, there are only two people out of this 17 that are in their 60s, and when they're killed under these varied circumstances, Whaley, the cab driver, was apparently hemmed up on the Trinity River Bridge.
Now, Oswald was supposed to have traveled in Whaley's cab,
right,
is that correct?
Right. Earlene Roberts was...
landlady.
Well, not the landlady. She was the housekeeper for the landlady. And she's the one who accepted Oswald as a room. At the rooming house, and she's the one who saw Oswald when he rushed back into his room, rushed through the hallway where Ms. Roberts was trying to tune the TV, rushed into his room for 2 or 3 minutes. And while he was in his room, Ms. Roberts said a Dallas police car drove up in front of the house and honked the horn. She said the horn went tit, tit, and when
I thought
she,
that was a fascinating detail.
Yes,
I remember.
When she went to the door, she thought maybe someone was calling her, because policemen had been coming by and talking with her.
She even ventured a recollection as to the numbers that were on the
Yes, they
cars,
pretty well confused her on the numbers, but she gave the names of the two officers who had been coming by to talk with her. She said one of them she thought was Officer Alexander, and then the other one was George Burnley. Well, now, I know of no newsman that talked to this lady after she gave that amazing testimony. She went into hiding, and, of course, she died before, as far as I know, anyone of a newspaper career talked to her.
She died before she was accessible to any news.
Yes,
I see.
And I think the commission was remiss, because she said, I thought it was Officer Alexander. The commission didn't even ask her Alexander's first name. And then they misspelled Burnley's last name, so that we can't find Alexander. And even if we go talk to Officer George Burnley on the Dallas Police Force, he can claim that not me, because that's not the way I spell my name. This happened so many times in the testimony and exhibits that I think it is not a mistake. I think if we use the technology that has been developed, we could certainly find out whether or not questions were asked as to the correct spelling of many of these names, which may be important.
I wanted to ask you, with reference to the police car that Earlene Roberts said she saw, I believe the commission maintained that there was no police car with that particular number on it. Do you feel that it was a police car, or do you feel it was something else? She obviously saw something. I think everyone would agree to that. Is it
a police car? Yes, I feel it was a police car.
You do?
Yes, I feel it was a police car. I'm not sure whose car it was, of course, but I certainly feel that it was a police car. I think the activities of Officer Tippett, and the fact that we now know that he was sitting at the end of the bridge, or rather his car was sitting at the end of the bridge at a Gloco station in Oak Cliff, and he was outside of the car observing traffic coming across from the assassination site.
Now, Oak Cliff is the west, is it, and south of...
South and west of the assassination site. It's a part of Dallas, but it's across the river. It's referred to as Oak Cliff. But
in other words, you're placing him there within what period of time after the assassination?
Within 20 minutes after the assassination, 15 or 20 minutes after the assassination, because we know from the police radio logs that he moved immediately into the area.
Why was he out of his area of competence, so to speak? Isn't that am I correct in saying that he was in an area where he wasn't regularly patrolling?
Yes, that's true, but there may be good reason for that, because of the nature of the visit. They were assigning people, had more people on duty that day, and had him on the outer limits of the city, really south of the Oak Cliff area. And when the trouble happened, then they called him closer into the city as they called more and more policemen into the assassination site. I think that the fact that he was there watching the traffic as it came from the assassination site, and then he rapidly drove away from that position down Lancaster Street, and we don't know where he went from then, but he could have been, although there were dozens of other police cars in the area at the time, he could have been the one who drove by the Oswald house, and I think it's not too far out to assume that he might have been giving a signal by tipping the horn that way.
Well, then what you're really saying is that you feel that not only was there a link between Oswald and Ruby, but you feel that there was a link between Tippett and Oswald.
Yes, I think that I know that that Ruby and Tippett were very close friends, and I know that I feel very strongly that I cannot give you all of the... There is other evidence besides Carol Jarnigan that Ruby and Oswald knew each other, and if they knew each other, then Oswald and Tippett may have known each other. I don't have any...
Now, this question, of course, was put to Oswald by the Chief Justice when he went to Dallas.
You mean by Ruby?
The question was put to Ruby.
Yes.
As to whether he had any knowledge or any relationship with Officer Tippett, and he denied this at the time, although it wasn't a very satisfactory denial. I brought that testimony. I think we might turn to that now. I think it's terrifying to read, and its implications. The Chief Justice is questioning Ruby. Ruby is saying, unless you can get me to Washington, I'm not a crackpot. I have all my senses. I don't want to evade any crime I'm guilty of. But if I spoke in this way when we talked, he continues, he says, unless you get me to Washington immediately, I'm afraid after what Mr. Tannehill has written there, which is unfair to me regarding my testimony here. He says, you all want to hear what he wrote. One wonders about this. Do you feel that if Ruby got to Washington, he would reveal things that he was reluctant to reveal in the Dallas jail, where he was largely in the hands of his intimates, his old friends, the Dallas police?
I certainly think that any criminal lawyer would feel that it's fair to assume that Ruby knew what he was talking about, because Ruby knew the police as no one else knows them, and I feel very strongly that the police spent hours convincing Ruby that he ought to kill Oswald. I can almost name the policeman. I think this patrolman Olson, who spent hours with Ruby on Friday night, and Belli said he also spent hours with Ruby on Saturday night, and then Chief Curry a few weeks after the assassination and before the Ruby trial, Curry told Olson that it'd be best if he left the police force. And he left the state, and Belli was not able to find him to have Olson to testify. And I certainly think that Jack Ruby should have been given the opportunity to go to Washington and tell whatever he had on his mind at that time, because I think he may realize after he was so rudely, I think he really thought that he was going to be a hero when he killed Oswald. And now that he's not, then he might someday tell us, but he's not going to tell us as long as he's in the Dallas jail.
He asks Justice Warren, he says, are you staying overnight here, Chief Warren? And the Chief Justice replies, no, I have to be back because we have an early session of the court tomorrow morning. And this seems to me amazing. I hope I'm not interpreting the testimony unfairly, but one has the impression after reading the interrogation of Ruby in detail that they would want to get him to Washington. Of course, the question arises, were there any legal impediments that would have prevented Ruby from being taken to Washington? He was in custody in the Dallas jail. He was awaiting trial on a murder charge. What are the...
Well, the commission had subpoena power, and I believe if Ruby were willing to waive his extradition from the state of Texas, that I don't see anything that would really impede his trip to Washington to say whatever he wanted to say. There's so many things in that Ruby testimony that's detrimental to the commission and that shows, I feel, that the commission were remiss in their duty to their country. And one of them involves the testimony of George Senator.
Yes.
Now, the commission just could not tell the story as Senator told it if they intended to stick to their story that Oswald did the job alone. And I refer to the Sunday morning meeting when Senator was having breakfast in the Eatwell Cafe, and the news came over the radio that Oswald had been shot. Now, the commission in the report says that Senator, when he heard, said that Senator was not acting like a guilty man, because when Senator heard that Ruby had shot Oswald, he jumped up and called his attorney. Well, now, that is not true. Senator said, when I heard Oswald had been shot, I jumped up and called my lawyer.
Hmm.
When I heard 5 or 10 minutes later that Ruby shot Oswald, I jumped in my car and went to the lawyer's house. Now, that's not the story that the commission told. And the commission knew they were not giving us the facts there, because in the Ruby testimony, from which you were just reading a few pages over, Ruby told them in his lie detector testimony that he told Senator he was going to kill Oswald. So the commission knew from Ruby's statement and from Senator's statement that their review of Senator's activities were untrue. And I think it's a justifiable complaint against the commission and the staff or whoever responsible for
it. You feel they've misrepresented the testimony?
It certainly misrepresents the truth.
With reference to the polygraph test that was administered to Ruby, you have a chapter on that, as I recall, in which you merely reproduce the testimony and the conversations between Ruby and Tannehill and others with reference to the preparation of the questions that were going to make up the polygraph test.
Yes.
It seems to me incredible that that Ruby would be permitted to make suggestions or deletions in what was to be asked.
Ruby actually guided the questioning at times, and I know from experience when my place was fired. Bomb, the police asked me.
Now, was this in connection with your articles on the assassination? Or
no, 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 this was earlier. But I simply say that I know a little bit about lie detector tests since I took one. This was in 1962. And they do not, in the normal lie detector test, permit you to guide the questioning. This is amazing to me that we've got trained lawyers here who were conducting this investigation, and they apparently know so little about the case that they permit their prisoner to direct the questioning.
Well, didn't Ruby himself only last year, I believe it was in the spring of 1965, didn't he cast doubts on the polygraph test that was administered to him by saying to reporters when he was being taken from his cell to the courtroom, he made several charges. First of all, he said there was a plot or a conspiracy relating to the assassination that was being covered up, and that he was not permitted to talk.
Yes.
And at that time, did he not say that Justice Warren had not made available the results of the lie detector test? Is that correct?
Yes, but of course, you see, so many people say, well, he's just a nut. He's really off. Look at what he said. He's really a kook. But I do not think that we should jump to conclusions like that. Particularly do I think so in view of the fact that during the Ruby trial, Ruby's plea of insanity was rejected by the jury. And then just last spring, we had another sanity trial in Dallas where he was adjudged sane. So twice now, the courts have acted on his sanity. And I think that in view of those actions, we must proceed by assuming that he is at this time sane and should pay some attention to the things that he has to say.
I want to ask you, what do you feel is Ruby's fate? What lies ahead for him? Do you see an eventual release for him, a long imprisonment?
No. No. I have already made the prediction in print that he will be killed, but not legally executed. I think that he's going to be murdered. Not in Dallas. They've had enough killings in Dallas. But I think that someday he's going to be adjudged insane and will be moved out to one of the state insane asylums in some little town where he probably will meet his fate at the hands of maybe an enraged inmate. This is certainly speculation, but that's the way I think the man knows too much. I think he was very small in the conspiracy to kill the president. I look at this conspiracy to kill the president as compared with a giant mosaic made up of thousands of threads. And I think that both Ruby and Oswald were very little men and maybe had only one thread to put in place in this mosaic. But I think that they were watched. They were carefully watched to see that they put that thread in place at the time it was supposed to be put in place. I think Oswald told the truth on Friday night at 7:55 when he almost screamed to a bunch of reporters, "I'm just a patsy."
Well, that remark was cut out of some of the television.
That's true. It was cut out,
tapes.
But certainly there's no
doubt
that
he's... It has been played once since then. I believe a number of researchers have made...
Well, it's in the notes of Thayer Waldo.
Yes.
And, Seth Kanner.
Seth Kanner
and Waldo,
the Scripps Howard reporter.
Yes.
Now, he maintains that he saw Ruby at Parkland Hospital shortly after the assassination. The commission discounts his testimony, even though there was a corroborating witness. It seems to me that there are strong arguments for his being there, that he saw Jack Ruby, is what I'm saying.
Yes, I feel certain that Ruby was at the hospital. Will Matthijs saw him, and I was at the hospital, and I took pictures. Although I was almost in a complete state of shock, I was snapping pictures of just the area outside of the hospital, and I feel quite positive that I have a picture of Jack Ruby leaving Parkland Hospital. Every newsman in the Dallas area who has looked at that picture claims they also feel that it is Jack Ruby, but unfortunately, it is a picture from the rear as Ruby is leaving the hospital.
Well, there's another photographer by the name of Willis in Dallas who has some photographs. The Willis sequence is published in one of the supporting volumes of exhibits in the 26 volumes. And in one of those, it's alleged that a person resembling Ruby is present outside the depository within a very short time after the assassination.
Yes.
Do you believe that to be true? I believe the picture's been cropped.
The main reason that I believe it's probably true is because the Warren Commission did crop it before they included it in their report. And that's another criticism that I have of the Warren Commission, is that they would permit mutilation of evidence this way.
This is what I wanted to get to, Mr. Jones, this question of whether the Warren Commission merely did an inadequate job in the mind of critics, or whether some critics can justifiably go farther and say there was a professional deformation of evidence. I was reading through some of the volumes just the other day with reference to some material pieces of evidence. Frazier, I believe his name is, one of the FBI firearms experts, has this testimony. I want to quote it to you, and I have some questions to address to you after I've read it. He's speaking of some of Governor Connally's clothing. This is on page 65 of volume 5. He says, "I found in the cuff of the shirt, which is a French cuff, through both the outer and inner layers of the cuff, a hole which is ragged in contour, irregularly shaped, and which had more or less star-shaped tears extending outward from the hole into the material, located 1.5 inches up from the end of the sleeve and 5.5 inches from the outside cufflink hole, though both, as I said, through both layers of the cuff, and the hole was in such a condition, possibly due to the washing of the material, that I could not determine what actually caused it, or if it had been caused by a bullet, the direction of the path of the bullet with reference to entrance and exit." Now, it seems to me what he's saying there, that Governor, that some material evidence in the case has been laundered. And by whom?
I think that is destruction of evidence. And I not only did they permit the mutilation of evidence by cropping of pictures and by the tearing of the Zapruder frames and gluing them back together, but they didn't even raise their eyebrows. Not a question was asked.
Has the commission replied to this at all? Have they made any?
To my knowledge, they have not. They have not. But this business, you know, in World War I, they could project the angle from which the long-range artillery shells were coming into France by the scars on the walls. And I believe that if the clothing of Governor Connally had not been cleaned and pressed and laundered, that we would have been able to tell a little bit about the angle of the bullet that hit Governor Connally. And the commission didn't even bother to ask a single question about why the governor's clothing was cleaned and pressed.
Where is the clothing now?
I think it's in the state of Texas archives, but as far as its value has no more value as evidence because of the cleaning and pressing that it got.
The next question that I want to ask is, where do we go from here in terms of the case? I was reading in the New York Times yesterday, the September 25th issue. There's an article on the editorial page by Tom Wicker, and he's speaking of a public discussion Commission Group in New York, which recently held a roundtable session about the Warren Commission report and its conclusion. And he points out that the major difficulty for the group was finding anyone of stature who was willing to defend the Warren report and its findings. He makes a review of the evidence. He feels that there should be a new investigation, or he's quoting people who feel that there should be a new investigation. You've proposed such an investigation.
Yes.
And you've described the kind of investigation it should be. Would you?
Yes. Well, of course, my book is a compilation of a series of articles which appeared in my newspaper. And in the beginning, I felt like that we should reopen the Warren Commission. But the further I got into this, I do not think that reopening the Warren Commission is the answer. I would like now very much to see a congressional investigation, something similar to the congressional investigation after the Roberts Commission on the Pearl Harbor incident. But I don't know. I hope that Congress will do it. I'm critical of the president because initially Congress started steps toward an investigation of the assassination of President.
They initiated steps for an investigation prior to the president's appointing a Blue Ribbon Commission.
And then the president appointed this Blue Ribbon Commission, which really isn't a Blue Ribbon Commission at all except in name. These were the names of great Americans on this commission. But in my opinion, in the eyes of history, the Warren Commission report will completely ruin Earl Warren in the eyes of history. You know, when the ship is sunk or the battle is lost, the captain has to take the blame. And Chairman Earl Warren will have to take the blame for this thing, in my opinion, in the eyes of history. I really feel it would have been better if President Johnson, coming to the presidency as he did, should have just stepped aside and said, okay, I will let Congress, you go ahead and investigate this thing, and if you need any power or any resources from me, it's available to you.
We've been talking to Penn Jones Jr., the author of a new book called Forgive My Grief, a critical review of the Warren Commission report of the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. You were a general in the Army, you were a member of the Texas 36th Infantry Division, and you've distinguished yourself in journalism. And where do you go from here, Mr. Jones? You have meetings at the Center of Study for the Center of Democratic Institutions in Santa Barbara.
Yes, Bishop Pike has been very generous to invite us up, and so is Mr. Scheinbaum, and I'm looking forward to it. That's the number one place I would like to visit in this great state of California, is this study at the Santa Barbara. From there, then we go on to San Francisco for several appearances, and then from there to Denver, where I will be talking on Sunday night.
We enjoyed visiting with you in Midlothian, and I was surprised and delighted that you could take time out from your busy schedule while you're here in California to come and talk with us in the studio. Thank you again.
Thank you.
If you like what you hear every week and want to learn more about the assassination, please pick up my book, The End of Innocence, The Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's available right now on Amazon, and it's on sale. Or you can find it at www.endofinnocencejfk.com. And hey, send me your comments about the book or this podcast at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. Please email any questions you would like for us to cover in a future podcast. Like I stated earlier, we're going to do a new segment on the podcast where we answer listeners' questions that have emailed in to me. So get your questions ready and we'll try to answer them the best we can. We'll see you next week.